Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Today is January 27th, and we are in Judges, ready to start chapter 12. We're still within the story of Jephthah, who you will remember by way of as brief a review as I can do, is from Gilead, the Transjordan territory that spans at least parts of East Manasseh, Gad, and Reuben tribal territories. But those tribal territories don't seem to have the identity that they had when the land was parceled out 300 years earlier. We hear a lot more references to Gilead on that side of the Jordan than anything else, not only here but elsewhere in the Old Testament history books from this point on. Jephthah had a lot of disadvantages starting out, parallel to Abimelech from the story before, but unlike Abimelech, he doesn't leverage that disadvantage in evil ways. And when Israel is looking for help to fight off the Ammonite oppression that they've been dealing with for 18 years, they turn to Jephthah, who'd been disowned by his own half-brothers, had moved up to the northeast in what today would probably be part of the Golan Heights. And they negotiated with him to come and help them, which he agreed to do, once they said that he would not only be their military commander, but also their leader. We looked last week at the diplomatic effort that he made with the Ammonite king to try to settle this without warfare, and how that failed. We looked at the military conflict itself, of which precious little is said, only that the fight took place, that the Israelites won handily. Because the second part of that story is focused much more on the vow that Jephthah made, and we spent quite a bit of time on that as well. Because the language in that part of the story is a little difficult. Either Jephthah made a vow that locked him into offering his daughter as a human sacrifice and a burnt offering, or he made a vow that locked him into dedicating his daughter to the Lord so that she would leave him, live apart. There are reasons to think both ways, and I told you my opinion, but it's not an opinion that I would go to the mat for. It's just very hard, and everything comes down to how that vow was worded. And there's nothing else in the story that absolutely unlocks for us the answer to which way that vow was worded. Was it, I will do this and this, or I will do this or this? We can't tell. Even when he reaches the point where he fulfills the vow, the story doesn't tell us what he did. It just says that he fulfilled the vow, which sends us back up to the original vow, which is ambiguous. But the lessons there transcend whether he killed his daughter or not. Because either way, he lost his daughter. Either way, he lost the hope he had to gain a family and a heritage and a legacy and no longer be an empty man, as they called him early in the story. Either way, his vow was poorly worded. I don't want to say foolishly made, because there are ample precedents in the Old Testament for vows that were made. Hannah, the mother of Samuel, Jonah, Israel in Numbers 21, when they were in a bad spot militarily. The vows exist. Someone made the comment last week that I think is worth considering, that the way Jephthah does word this vow, whichever way it falls, if it is an either-or vow, it almost sounds like he's trying to maintain some control over God, over what he has to do in response to God's help. That may have been the problem. He didn't have to make the vow. But if you look at it from Jephthah's point of view, to the extent that we are given it in the story, there is no point at which God visits him and says, I'm raising you up to do this. So Jephthah may have felt the vow was more appropriate if he didn't have that kind of assurance the way Gideon did with a special visit from God. In any case, yet another judge who shows himself to be just as human and fallible as we are, whether that is limited to making a vow that was ill-conceived or actually being willing to kill his own daughter. That took us through last week. Jephthah's story, however, is not quite over. So we need to look at the rest of it this week, and I don't think it will take us a tremendously long time, so we may get into the next story as well. There's a succession of three judges about whom we know almost nothing that are going to come up after Jephthah, and then the big story of judges, Samson. But even Samson does not end the book of Judges. He's the last judge who's described in this book. He's not the last judge. He's the last judge described in this book. But as we someday get into 1 Samuel, we'll see that Eli is a judge. Samuel is a judge. Samuel's sons are judges. So there are other judges after Samson, if the chronology is linear. But Samson's the last one that this book will deal with. But first, let's finish Jephthah. We're at chapter 12, right at the beginning. And Jephthah's military victory is done, and he has a problem. Sorry, I've got some kind of debris on my screen here that's making me do things that change the page. Okay. He's got a problem, and it's the same problem Gideon had. When everything is done, the Ephraimites are mad at him. Take a look back in Judges 8. It's worth looking at. Also, right at the beginning of that chapter, where we read, the Ephraimites said to Gideon, "Why have you done such a thing to us? You did not summon us when you went to fight the Midianites." They argued vehemently with him. He said to them, "Now what have I accomplished compared to you? Even Ephraim's leftover grapes are better quality than Abiezer's harvest," which is Gideon's own tribe, clan. "It was to you that God handed over the Midianite generals, Oreb and Zeeb. What did I accomplish to rival that?" When he said this, they calmed down. So, you remember, if you remember the story, Gideon had his army whittled down to just 300 men to fight the Midianites. And they really didn't have to do much fighting because the Midianites became confused and turned on each other in the night. But they did pursue them, and Gideon put out the call for help to cut them off in their flight to try to get back across the Jordan to the east. And Ephraim was part of the answer to that call. And they did, in fact, intercept those two generals. But they were upset that they hadn't been invited to the main party. Gideon's way of handling it was pretty obsequious, honestly. He smothers ego-feeding praise on them and says, guys, you're way better than we are. The worst, your worst is better than my best. You captured these generals. I mean, you did great. On a moment's notice, you guys were awesome. And Ephraim is appeased by that. But it's coming up now again. The truth back then was that Ephraim wasn't meant to be part of the main party, the main battle that Gideon fought. God had a certain way of doing it. His way of doing it made sure that all the glory should go to God himself. And Ephraim, seeking glory by wishing they'd been invited to the party, was not part of God's plan. Gideon didn't pitch it that way. He deflected. Jephthah's a little more of a straight shooter. And when Ephraim comes to him here in chapter 12, he responds very much the way he responded in his diplomatic efforts with the Ammonite king. He's respectful, polite, but he tells it like it is. Verse 1 of chapter 12, the men of Ephraim were called to arms, and they crossed to Zaphon and said to Jephthah, so they crossed over to the east side of the Jordan, and said to Jephthah, why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites and did not call us to go with you? Ephraim is seeking glory again. We will burn your house over you with fire. We're going to burn your house down with you inside. Sweet guys. Israelite threatening Israelite too, which is a problem that we saw in Gideon's story. Not only with Ephraim, but with Gideon himself, when he attacked the towns of Penuel and Succoth because they wouldn't help him when he wanted it. Now the Ephraimites are threatening to attack Jephthah militarily and personally. And verse 2, Jephthah said to them, I and my people had a great dispute with the Ammonites. And when I called you, you did not save me from their hand. And when I saw that you would not save me, I took my life in my hand and crossed over against the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me? So just as the Ammonite king had his history wrong, so do the Ephraimites now. And it's a lot more recent history. It's not 300 years ago. They're saying, why didn't you call us to come help fight? And he says, I did. You didn't show. So we did it ourselves. Verse 4, then Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead. Sorry, guys, we're not done yet. Got to rally the troops one more time. And fought with Ephraim. So we have internal civil strife between tribes of Israel. And the men of Gilead struck Ephraim because they said, you are fugitives of Ephraim, you Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and Manasseh. It may not come across well in translation, but they're throwing an insult at the Gileadites. They're saying, you're not a tribe unto yourself. You're just a bunch of refugees from Ephraim and Manasseh, sitting there in between them. Which is a really interesting phrase, fugitives of Ephraim, because of what happens two sentences later. Verse 5, and the Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan. Remember back in the Gideon story, it was the Ephraimites who captured the fords and controlled who could cross over. Now it's the Gileadites who capture the fords of the Jordan against the Ephraimites. So now the Ephraimites are cut off from going back to their home. And notice the back part of verse 5. And when any of the Ephraimites, oops, that's not what it says. And when any of the fugitives of Ephraim, in the space of two sentences, that phrase, fugitives of Ephraim, has been turned 180 degrees in its meaning. The Ephraimites used it as an insult against the Gileadites. You're just fugitives from Ephraim. Now the Ephraimites themselves are fugitives, cut off from their land in the midst of the Gileadites. It's a very sudden 180-degree ironic twist that the writer of Judges is making sure is put in there. The same phrase, just two sentences apart, with exactly opposite meanings. So Ephraim has lost this battle. And when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, "Let me go over," wanting to go home, the men of Gilead said to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" Which they wouldn't necessarily just assume, because don't think that this particular event is all happening in the space of one afternoon. The fords of the Jordan are a trafficked place. So there are other people with legitimate reasons to go over. And if the Ephraimites are trapped on the east side, the odds are they've gone into hiding, and they're trying to work their way back. That's not just a matter of an hour or two. This probably stretched on for days. And when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, "Let me go over," the men of Gilead would say to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" And when he said no, because of course if he said yes, they'd kill him. So when he said no, then they would say to him, "Then say Shibboleth." And the Ephraimite would say Sibboleth, for he could not pronounce it correctly. Then they seized him and slaughtered him at the fords of the Jordan. At that time, 42,000 of the Ephraimites fell. Not all, because they couldn't say Shibboleth. I'm sure that includes the original battle as well, but that's the way the thing unfolded. Now let me just say something about that whole Shibboleth, Sibboleth thing, because it sounds kind of odd, doesn't it? I mean, these are all Israelites. These are all descendants from the same set of 12 brothers. They just live across the valley from each other. Seriously? The Ephraimites couldn't pronounce an SH sound? Well, some of you know I'm a bit of a language geek. And I gotta tell you, this is totally believable. And I can give you examples from my own experience. My strongest foreign language is German. I used to be fluent in it. If I could use it as much as I used to, I still would be. There's a sound in German that's spelled with a CH. And when everybody hears German, they think it's this very guttural, consonantal language, and in many places it is. People joke that it sounds like Klingon. But the CH has different sounds. It can be hard, which is very guttural. It's got that sound, like Johann Sebastian Bach. But it also has a soft sound. And whether it's hard or soft depends on what vowel comes in front of it. And when you learn this as a language student, it all sounds very complicated. But when you grow up with it, you don't even think about it. And if somebody points out the rule, the Germans will say, "Really? Yeah, I guess that's true." So the soft CH sound is a sound that I could not make when I was an early German student. I couldn't do it. And I struggled with it for a year and a half. Actually, 2.5 years. I struggled with it for 2.5 years. And finally, a student who had grown up in Austria and Switzerland helped me in class one day off on the side to work out how to make that sound, because I was basically making it like an English SH, and it isn't. It's pronounced, which sounds like a cat hissing. So while you have a word like Bach that has that hard CH, you've got a word like mich, which means me, that has a soft CH. But I couldn't say it. And she finally made me realize that it's the same as the English H when it's followed by a long U, like the word huge. I never thought about it, but the way English forms its H's is totally dependent on the vowel that comes next. Hot and huge, you make the H different ways. And so with the other vowels as well. So the H in front of the word huge, if you really emphasize it, I mean, this thing wasn't just big, it was huge. That's the German soft CH. So I get it when judges says that they couldn't make the sound. And don't assume that it's just our SH versus our S, shibboleth and sibboleth. I don't know the nuances of Hebrew pronunciation, much less Hebrew pronunciation that many centuries ago. It may not have been a simple SH. It may have been something a little different. And I'll say more, but Kyle has the thought. Go ahead.
What they teach us is that it's the specific letter, it's either shin or sin, and in the manuscripts we read, there's a dot to mark it, but back then they didn't use any of that. They didn't even put vowels in, so it really depended on where you're from, how you pronounce it. So it's a regional thing there. So.
There are linguists in Europe who can tell the difference in dialect between people who are from villages that are just on opposite sides of the mountain, because their pronunciations are just a little different. When I was a seminarian, I met a couple who lived down the hall from us in the housing, and they were from Indiana, northern Indiana. I was from Michigan. I hadn't spoken two sentences when the wife said, "You're from Michigan." Blew me away. I didn't even realize there was a difference. I thought I sounded like Tom Brokaw on the nightly news. When I was in Sweden, I had a friend who had to go off to, I was visiting him, and he had to go off to classes at the college one day, and his girlfriend spent the afternoon with me, and we ended up trying to figure out some of the pronunciations in Swedish that I was having trouble with. Swedish has this S-J combination, and to this day, I can't even begin to tell you what it sounds like. She worked with me for 2 hours on that, and I couldn't even begin to do it. It doesn't sound like an S, it doesn't sound like a J, it kind of sounds like an F with a lot of breathing and an L hidden in there somewhere. I can't do it. I can't do it. If I had had to cross the fords and prove that I was Swedish, I was a dead man.
Well, it's funny. They tell this story about prisoners in Vietnam in the Hanoi Hilton that they would use the as a signal between Americans.
Yeah.
Because the Vietnamese at the time could not get that pattern down.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so they talk about that all the time. They instantly knew if it was an American because they would do it. The other guy would answer, and they would know who was in the next door, you know. And so, it's funny that something as simple as that couldn't be deciphered.
Yeah, the cultural things that we take for granted, but that for whatever reason are difficult for another culture. Yeah, yeah. You know how Spanish trill their R's at the front of the mouth? I can't trill an R to save my life. I cannot do it. I can roll an R at the back of my mouth, but I can't trill an R at the front. Fortunately for me, 60% of Germans roll their R's and 40% trill their R's, so I'm in the slight majority. But for the people I work with at the seminary who deal with Hispanic ministry, they trill those R's all the time, and I just am so jealous. Can't do it. Cannot do it. The same people can stick their tongue out, curled, by the way, into a tube. I can't do that either. I think there's a correlation. So there's example after example after example. Yeah. Go ahead.
What I always think of is how the car company will say Volkswagen. Well, in German, it's Volkswagen.
You did that backwards.
Volks.
Yeah, for them, it's Volks with an S.
Volkswagen, yes. Yeah. Volkswagen.
Yeah. Yes. Our V is pronounced as an F to them, and our W in wagon is pronounced as a V to them. So they have a V. They just have it later in the word. It's very strange. Ben, was that a hand? Okay.
So
all
right. Porsche.
Yeah.
Porsche. There are no silent E's in German. Not a one. Well, except for a couple of words borrowed from French. It's true. Anyway, so Shibboleth, it's completely believable from many, many experiences I've had dealing with languages. And sadly, some of them being my own incapabilities of passing the test. Like the question of whether Jephtha killed his daughter or not, this Shibboleth-Sibboleth thing can tend to fixate us so that we miss the bigger point here. And the bigger point here is that Israel is now doing war with itself. That's a big deal. It was a big deal when Gideon did it, but now it's happening on a larger scale. It's not just one man on a revenge mission against the kings who killed his family. That's what it was for Gideon. Now it's bigger. Now it's at the tribal level. And that's not a good thing. And it's not over yet. So that's the story of Gideon. Sorry. Wrong story. I keep switching back and forth between them. I figured I'd do that before today was over. That's the story of Jephtha. There are a couple of lessons in it, some of which we've touched on just in the last few minutes, but I want to get up 10,000 feet and say a couple of things as we look back over it. And the main one really is that when we try to take the glory that is God's, there are always problems. Ephraim wanted to take the glory that was God's for the victory, both here and with Gideon. And here, it ended up in bloodshed because they were willing to go to war against their brothers. It is possible, I don't like teaching something where I can't say categorically what's going on, but sometimes it's just not possible. It is possible, depending on how we understand Jephthah's vow, that he was trying to take some of the glory away from God in the situation. And whether he ended up having to kill his daughter or just send her away, that didn't end up too well either. That's the most important story in this, and it's a story that happens, a lesson that is seen over and over in Judges. Within the context and the structure of Jephthah's own story, there's another lesson that comes into play, and that is words matter. Over and over and over again in this story, words matter. The Ammonite king had a justification for wanting to oppress Israel and take back land, but it was based on a false history. His version of what had happened 300 years earlier was incorrect. Truth matters. History matters. Words matter. The same thing happens with the Ephraimites. What had happened just in the last days, they recast into a different narrative. I almost hate to say narrative, it's such an overused word in secular society today, but it's biblical stuff and narrative. We were using the word narrative way before they were, so I'll keep using it. They changed the narrative, and it's not true. And Jephtha corrects them and reminds them of what was true, and that's part of what leads to the war. Words and truth and history matter. Being able to pronounce the word mattered to the lives of some of the Ephraimites who were trying to get back across the Jordan. And in an ironic sort of meta level above all of this story, words matter because we're not sure which way to translate that one little conjunction in Jephthah's vow. And it matters to how we understand the story. So it's a lesson everywhere you look in Jephthah's story. Words matter. Truth matters. History matters. That's a big one. I'll stop there with Jephthah. Any thoughts or questions on your part before we jump into the next section? Yeah, it would.
But you're saying from a standpoint, that's enormous numbers.
Yeah. No argument. It would be interesting, and I haven't done it, and I'm not going to here in the moment, because it would be too disruptive, but it would be interesting to look back 300 years to the census when they first came into the land and how many Ephraimites there were then. And I don't know how you account for growth when you don't know how much military strife there's been, and but 42,000 is a chunk no matter what. Kyle, were you going to say something?
I've been thinking about it kind of all week. Just, you know, we want to take the four, but, you know, thinking, what if it is Ann? If he did offer his daughter as a burnt sacrifice? I think it falls within kind of the way we can read Judges as a story of this nation that was, you know, set apart. God, you know, chose them, and he brought them into this land, how they're becoming more and more like the other nations. And I think that, you know, the fact that the Ephraimites and the Gileadites, you know, they end up fighting each other, that just kind of cements that they're not even, you know, Israel anymore. They're just different nations fighting each other.
Definitely. Yeah, and let me just say for emphasis, because I don't want to be misunderstood, I lean toward understanding Jephthah's vow as an or, and leaning toward understanding it as him not killing his daughter. But it is totally defensible to understand it the other way. And in some ways, it's even, if I dare say it, more logical to understand it the other way, because then he fits better into this progression, but it's really a regression of the judges being worse and worse and worse in their flaws as we go through the story. It may very well be that that's what happened. It's just, I find it impossible to draw a 100% conclusion from the way that it's written.
I just think it's one of those places where, especially if you run into people who are hostile against, you know, they'll point to this particular story. Well, you know, how come it says, you know, in the law that you shouldn't do human sacrifices, but look, there's a human sacrifice, and trying to understand that it's just an example of somebody not living faithfully according to God's word in, you know, the scriptures. And
Judges is just filled with it.
Right.
It's the hallmark of the book. Yep. You're absolutely right. Anyone else?
I kind of keep coming back and thinking, see, these guys are all out of the garden doing God's will. It seems like almost all of them, and somewhere along the line, they go off of the deep of the path and do something real anti-God or out of the way they should behave. And it doesn't really show that they even repented of what they did. But still, they're held in high regard because they did the job that God had them to do at the time. And which kind of comes back to self-incrimination. Do we always do what God asks us to do, or we say, oh, I can't do that because I'm, you know, whatever. I'm damaged goods, so I can't really do what God wants me to do. I think God even uses well, God uses sinful men to do his will.
With one exception, that's all he had to work with.
Yeah.
There's a Leonard Cohen song, and I'm going to get the lyrics wrong. Maybe somebody else knows it, but the lyric runs... see, I'm getting it wrong already. It starts out with "Ring the bells." But the line that matters is, there's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. God uses broken vessels and cracked vessels. But sometimes, because we are cracked and broken vessels, what he puts into us to accomplish his will leaks back out. And we're seeing a lot of that in Judges. And that's a lesson for anyone, anywhere, anytime. But remember, too, I make the case, or try to, I think Samuel wrote this. We don't know for sure who wrote it. I think Samuel wrote it. And there's a lot in Judges, and I said this way back in the first week. There's a lot in Judges that suggests that it is written as an apologetic for the need for David to be the king. Because if you have a king, Israel, that you choose for yourself, as they did Saul, look at the history of what has happened when you have had leaders who maybe follow what God wants them to do, but then they fall. Saul is the natural end of that road. But then you look at Ruth, which I'm more confident than ever that we will get to this year, and you see how yielding to God's will in a more complete and submissive and humble way, humility is a big issue in Judges, that leads to a king like David, who is descended from Ruth. And I think that even though they were written at apparently different times, and certainly were originally placed in different parts of the Old Testament scriptures, they do really go together in a lot of logical ways, and that's one. It's this contrast between the path of fallible human effort that leads to a king like Saul and the path of submission to God that leads to a king like David. And I think that's a big part of why Samuel was writing Judges. Not just to say this is the history, but to say there's a lesson in this history. Thomas, what did you say to me last week? It's a quote from one of your professors, and it's one I've heard before. History is a conversation between the present and the past about the future. And Samuel is having a conversation with Israel about their past that we're studying here in Judges. But that conversation is about their future. You need a king like David. You don't need a king like Saul. Anyone else? Okay. The last part of chapter 12 does something we saw just before the Jephthah story as well. It mentions a couple, in this case three, judges about whom we are given almost no information. So let's at least look at them and acknowledge that they're there, because that's about all they get. So it's the least we can do. As I'm very fond of saying, it's the very least I could do, and I always try to do the very least I can. So, verse 8. After him, that is after Jephthah, Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel. He had 30 sons and 30 daughters he gave in marriage outside his clan, and 30 daughters he brought in from outside for his sons. And he judged Israel for 7 years. Then Ibzan died and was buried at Bethlehem. We don't know if there was some special conflict that raised him as a judge. Actually, we do know that because chapter 2 describes the whole dynamic that the book is going to follow. We just don't know any of the details. As we didn't for Jair or for Tola, we don't now for Ibzan either. The 30 sons and 30 daughters business, that's going to come up again, and it actually came up once before with either Tola or Jair. I don't remember which off the top of my head. But it's a sign of prosperity. It's a sign of status, wealth. It's also a sign of polygamy, by the way, and that shouldn't be ignored. Sometimes it talks about them riding donkeys, another sign of status and authority. So it may be that some of these judges are not people who were raised out of the gutter the way that Jephthah was, so to speak, but who already had station within the people of Israel. But ultimately, it's a bit speculative. Verse 11, after Ibzan, Elon, the Zebulunite, judged Israel, and he judged Israel 10 years. Then Elon, the Zebulunite, died and was buried at Ajalon in the land of Zebulun. We really don't know anything more. After him, Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Perathonite, judged Israel. What's a Perathonite? That sounds like a rare metal. No. We'll see later when we see he's buried at Pirathon. It's just the town he's from. The son of Hillel, the Perathonite, judged Israel. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys. So all of his children were in positions of authority. I think it was Jair that said that he had 30 sons on 30 donkeys and they ruled 30 cities. It's the kind of thing we're talking about here. Then Abdon, the son of Hillel, he judged 8 years, excuse me. Then he died and was buried at Pirathon in the land of Ephraim. So we didn't know it when it called him a Perathonite, but he's an Ephraimite. So Ephraim, with for all of their problems in the last couple of stories, has provided a judge for Israel as well. Good for them. Good for God. And he's buried in the hill country of the Amalekites. Which is, you know, that's almost its own little dig right there. I don't know that the author means it that way. But there aren't supposed to be any Amalekites anymore. It's supposed to be the hill country of Ephraim, and sometimes it's called that. But it's also the hill country of the Amalekites because they didn't drive them out. All right. So those three, possibly for the sake of completeness. And we come to chapter 13, which we'll just get started with today. The story of Samson is 4 chapters long. This is going to go 13, 14, 15, and 16. Chapter 13 is going to be his origins. And I certainly don't want to try to go any farther than that today. We may not even get all the way through that. 14 and 15 are well, I won't finish that sentence yet in a couple of weeks. Samson has a very different story in some ways, a very different story from other judges in this book. And that really comes out in chapter 13, right at the beginning. Samson is certainly the best known story from Judges. Samson is one of the stories that is so prominent that it does get into the children's Bible Sunday school lessons in a very sanitized form. And that's a problem, too. The familiarity we have with Samson's story is potentially a pitfall. So I want to challenge you to try to read, especially this first chapter, but the rest of it as well, with fresh eyes. Try to forget what you know about Samson. and just look at what is being said here as he is introduced for the first time into the story. Okay? It's not easy, but it's doable. And let me say one other thing, even though it's not really relevant for chapter 13. When you picture Samson, stop picturing Victor Mature. Samson was not a weightlifter. Samson was not a bodybuilding champion. Samson was not even muscle bound. Samson looked a lot more like my 5'9", 140-pound son than he did like Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is what made his strength all the more surprising to his enemies and all the more to the credit of God. Samson didn't look as strong as he was, not even close. I say that just as one example of why we need to try to shed what we think we know about Samson. Because some of our preconceptions are wrong. And I'm also going to say one other thing right here up front. If I say too many things up front, we're going to run out of time. The day will be over. But there are a remarkable number of parallels between the story of Samson and the story of one other well-known biblical figure. Give me a minute, I'll think of his name. Jesus. Right, that's it. There are a remarkable number of parallels between the story of Samson and the story of Jesus. And I know as soon as I say that, it's very easy to think, well, wait a minute, Samson had all these problems. Yes, he did, and those are not the parallels. But there are parallels. So it'll be fun to watch for those too. Okay, let's jump into this then. Chapter 13, verse 1. And the people of, boy, I can think of how I'm never going to get to Samson himself now because I've got like 10 minutes left. And I've just realized, oh yeah, this is how chapter 13 starts. And the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. So the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. Now, I don't know for sure about what I'm going to say next, but it doesn't really matter. A lot of the formula that we always see for these cycles isn't here. It starts out sounding like the same formula, and the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, but they never raise up a cry. They're never described as finally crying out to the Lord. And I think the reason for this is because we're not actually dealing with a new cycle. We're dealing with the western half of the cycle for which Jephthah was the eastern half. Remember, when Jephthah's story started, it talked about Israel was doing even greater evil, and it went into detail, and it said they were following the gods, and it named all the tribes around them and among them, and they were following all these false gods. And so God gave them into the hands of the Philistines and the Ammonites. And they did cry out to the Lord then, and he said, why? Why should I help you? Very much like Jephthah said, why should I help you? You kicked me out. God says, why should I help you? You're not faithful to me. But he finally does help them. The Jephthah story is how he helps them against the Ammonites. I think the Samson story is how he helps them against the Philistines. And I'll even go one step farther. If you add up the numbers for the judges we just looked at, it's not perfect arithmetic, but it comes pretty close to the 40 years that it says that they were oppressed by the Philistines. So I don't think we're in a new cycle. I think we're on the western side of the same time period that Jephthah was raised up. Now Samson is being raised up. So the Lord gave them into the hands of the Philistines for 40 years. There was a certain man of Zorah of the tribe of the Danites. That's a new one. That's part of the northern distribution of land, as I recall. No, wait. Dan. See, I don't have my maps with me today. Dan stretches right underneath. It's right there by Benjamin, isn't it? Somebody help me out here. Okay, we'll bring a map next time. Don't worry about it. He's from Dan. We haven't had a judge from Dan before. Whose name was Manoah. And his wife, we're never, don't worry about it. We're never told his wife's name. Best we can do is call her Mrs. Manoah. His wife was barren and had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Behold, you are barren and have not borne children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Therefore be careful and drink no wine or strong drink and eat nothing unclean. For behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. No razor shall come upon his head. For a child, shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb. And he shall begin," and I've checked every English translation that I've got my hands on, and there's nobody's translating it any other way, "and he shall begin to save Israel from the hand of the Philistines." Now let me stop there and say something about this. What's a Nazarite? We have to understand what a Nazarite is if we're going to understand Samson. That's one of the features, yes. But another feature, yes. But what is a Nazarite on a more general level? A Nazarite is someone who has made a vow to God. And the nature of the vow involves not cutting their hair for the duration of the vow. It's a temporary vow. In normal cases. And the hair is not cut until the end of the period of the vow. And then there's an offering, and the hair is cut, and the hair is also made part of the burnt offering.
So how long did this vow last? Like, is it decades? Is it weeks?
Whatever. It could be anything.
Okay.
It usually was thought of as something a little bit more than just a couple of days. I mean, the whole don't cut your hair thing plays to a longer time than that. But yeah, the description of it is, and I'm not going to ask you to turn there given the time, but the description of it, if you'd like to look at it in detail, is in Numbers chapter 6. That's where the law is, the legislation, the regulations about the Nazarite vow. But let me just summarize it for you. It's voluntary. But it wasn't voluntary for Samson, was it? But it was normally voluntary. A vow of separation unto God could be made by men or women. A particular period of time stipulated by the individual, and that stipulation is made at the beginning of the vow. They had to abstain not only from wine, but anything derived from grapes. So they couldn't have grapes, they couldn't have grape juice, they couldn't have grape skins, they couldn't have grape seeds, they couldn't have raisins. That's the hard one. They couldn't have contact with anything dead, not even if a member of their own family died. If there were any defilement that occurred during the period of the vow, the individual who made the vow had to go through a cleansing process and then begin the period all over again from scratch. And of course, they couldn't cut their hair for the period of the vow. But as I said, at the end of the vow period, sacrifices were offered to God, the hair was cut off and offered up on the sacrificial fire as well. That's the basics of a Nazarite vow. So it's an act of personal devotion. And it sounds odd to say that it was voluntary, as number six does. However, it needs to be pointed out that Samson is not the only involuntary Nazarite in the Bible. Anybody think of any others?
Samuel.
Hannah promised God not only that she would dedicate her son to God, but that he would be a Nazarite. Hannah made that decision for her son before he was ever conceived. Yes. And there's one more. John the Baptist was a Nazarite. And it wasn't his choice. It was established before he was born. So there's precedence. And Samson is going to be a Nazarite from the moment of his conception, literally. Because the angel is telling his mother, you must observe the restrictions of the Nazarite vow while he's growing inside you. And the last thing I'll say today is this. I think that's one of the most overlooked arguments in our modern cultural debates about the humanity of a fetus. Because the Nazarite vow applied to an unborn fetus in Mrs. Manoa. Well, humans are the subject of Nazarite vows. So, it's a strong indirect argument that all of those abortions that we're doing, not that I need to convince many here, are killing humans, not just killing prehumans or unviable tissues or whatever you may want to call them. The Nazarite vow being applied to Samson from his conception argues strongly for the humanity of the embryo, which is not the point of the story, but it's a point worth making. And now it is 10:20. And we never really did get to Samson. So that'll be next week. But there's some young people outside, some very civilized, hungry young people outside. So let's pray and let them and us get to this next. Heavenly Father, thank you for the lessons of these stories. Please help us to take to heart how much words do matter, how much truth does matter, especially in an age where stories are being spun for personal, political agendas that may ignore truth or just introduce flat-out falsehood. And it's happening from both sides of the political aisle in our country. And we're not the first to do it. Revolutions have been built on the truth recast. And we saw that happen with the Ammonite king, and we saw that happen with the Ephraimites in today's lesson. But it happens all around us. And if we're honest, in the times where we're the most conflicted about things that we've done or things that we really want, we're prone to do it ourselves. Help us to stand in the light of your truth and acknowledge with humility what the truth really is. We pray in Jesus' name.